Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and I'm here with Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and our special guest today, Dr. Jeff Mallinson. Today, we are finally starting our series on the great thinkers of the Christian faith. This is actually the episode after our introduction into this series, so you're going to need to go back one episode to listen to why we're starting this series and what you're going to be able to expect happening in the next, this is probably going to be at least 20-week long series. We have a lot of people.
22 planned.
So 22 planned for now. We'll probably add a few in there. We'll have guest episodes here and there in between there. So this is going to be a long series. It's a major milestone for us, sort of like the Apologetics series and the Loci series before that. And so we're going to try to bring on some of the best minds on these particular people, on these particular thinkers of Christianity. And so that's why we brought Dr. Jeff Mallinson on today to talk about Augustine. So, Dr. Keith, you want to introduce Dr. Mallinson? He's been on the show a couple times before.
Absolutely.
Once before, Jeff? I don't remember.
It was at least once.
Yeah.
I'm glad to be here.
The Augustana anniversary episode.
That's right.
June 25th.
Yes.
Dr. Mallinson was on that. So Dr. Mallinson is a professor at Concordia University Irvine, teaches theology and philosophy, has a sort of long history in teaching theology, history of theology, and in actually many different movements within theology. He'll be on later in this series to help us talk about Calvin as well. I know he's got a big background in Augustine, even named his son after Augustine.
Yep, the oldest one.
Yeah.
Augustine, in fact, I had a fight with my wife and the family because I went so far. This is so pretentious, and I despise myself for it. I tried to give him the middle name Viator.
Yeah,
that was his second middle name, so it's hidden. It's not on his driver's license, which is part of Augustine's allure for me, which is this guy who is absolutely committed to Christian orthodoxy and defending it at a very pivotal time in Western history. I mean, he's the guy in the West after all of the first controversies were settled by the greats like Athanasius. Here's a guy who comes along and establishes some very important things about grace, as opposed to the Pelagians we'll talk about, and the nature of the church against the Donatists. All these things are important, but to me, what makes him most interesting is that idea that even though we are faithful to the call of Christ and to Scripture, we are always kind of on this way. And the Lutherans come along, and the early Lutheran dogmaticians talk about the theology of the wayfarer, or the theologia viatorum. And so I think that that's an important thing. How do you get a guy who is so bright and resolute about orthodoxy, and yet he also recognizes a certain kind of humility in the midst of that as we're kind of progressing towards better understanding?
Right, and he's got an interesting story. One of the things we want to do with this series, sort of the great thinkers of the Christian faith, is to just tell their story more than anything. But sometimes I think it will be important to place them sort of in historical context.
Yeah.
So Augustine comes along. He's born in November of 354 AD. So for the listener, that's where we are in the time frame of Christian history. We're about 354 years after the birth of Christ. He's an interesting figure. He comes to us via adult conversion, right? So he has a very, how shall we say it, rich life prior to becoming a Christian.
nice way to say it.
Yeah, he's got an interesting relationship with his mother, which is kind of odd. In fact, over this past semester, I don't know if you remember, Jeff, but you asked me to cover your philosophy class.
Yes, you did.
And
yeah.
You said, hey, just talk about Augustine. I said, okay, well, that's interesting, so let's talk about Augustine. And I get into your class, and the first slide I put up is this weird picture of Augustine nursing as a baby at his mother's breast. And one of the girls raised her hand, and I think she's going to object to the picture, and she's like, dude, that boy's mom was crazy.
Oh, I already
She already knew that?
It was because she'd done the reading.
Wow.
I didn't get into his ideas, but I kind of told the story about how she was really trying hard.
Yeah.
But boy, was that
funny.
I don't know. I hope we can get into a little bit of it, because I think it's actually germane.
Yeah. All right. So so if you had to, and you do, so tell us the story of Augustine. Where would you start? And Adam, I mean, Adam being our resident historian, chime in at any point, too. And Rod, first time I read anything from Augustine was an assignment in your class. So please, nobody be shy here. But what's the story here?
Well, let's go early. Come on, it's great. So you got Monica, Saint Monica, and she is a Christian, and her husband's not so nice, maybe a little abusive. Early on in Monica's life, she was using, she was drinking the wine that she would carry as a like a food server, and she would start to kind of develop a little bit of an alcohol addiction as she's kind of going back and forth, and she finds in the church this grounding, right? And that's what a lot of people do when they find Christianity as a way to maybe kind of rein themselves in. And so she's praying for her boy all the time, wants him to come into the faith. Dad's not a Christian, and yet she also wants him to be successful in a worldly sense. So she's got that going on. And just let me give you one story, if I can. So here he is. He's going to go off to Milan, right? And mom is just way overbearing, as well-meaning as she is. He wants to go be somebody who studies rhetoric. He's going to go check out what Ambrose is doing, Saint Ambrose. And so he's. I don't even know if this is the real way it goes, but this is the movie, all right? So he's standing at the docks, and all of a sudden, mom's coming along with him. It's like when the kid, you know, Scott, when you used to have students whose moms maybe wanted to live on campus.
They lingered around too long on move-in day.
No.
You kind of had to go through the halls and be like, time to go home. Time to go home.
So Augustine,
time to go home.
After this long kind of crazy life with, you know, he doesn't get into as much trouble as he probably thinks he does, but he's, you know, he's got this, you know, sinful life that he recounts in the confessions. But he says, he gets to the docks, and there's mom with her bags.
Like, ready to go.
You're not coming with me. So he says, hey, I'm going to go say goodbye to my friends. I'll be right back. Swings around the restroom, gets on the boat and waves to her, and she's crying, you know. And in many ways, so that's kind of his whole life, interested in pleasing her and also trying to get his own distance, you know. And he never can really accept his mom's religion because he's got this big hang-up, and the hang-up is the problem of evil. You know, who made the birds? God did. Who made the syphilis?
No.
Who made the AIDS? Who made, well, whatever. I mean, so he has.
We did an
problem.
Episode on the problem of evil.
You did, right? There it is. And so that part was kind of hanging with him, and we'll pick up more of the story. But so he ends up going out, and he kind of figures it out on his own, and comes back to his mom's faith.
So tell us about his, if anyone really, tell us about his early life. What's the deal with him? So you're actually talking, he's going on for some schooling in rhetoric at that point, right? And so that's kind of oftentimes where you pick up the story.
Sure.
His initial education. How does that work out for him? Where does it go from there? Let's just tell the story. Adam, do you remember?
Sorry, I just had a burp. Well, you know, I don't know it as Jeff does, but so he goes through a sort of a, if you will, an evolution in his thinking. And I don't remember the order, but he's from philosophy to Manichaeanism. Mm-hmm. I remember in Dr. Rosenblatt's class on classical Christian thought, you had us read the Confessions. There's a memorable, it's the only line I remember from the book, and it's the most worthless line, but he says, "And yet again I found myself in a burning cauldron of lust."
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, he struggled especially with his attraction to females. He has is a child out of wedlock. I think he's he's pretty young. I think his son was named a gift of God. I forget the
Deodatus.
Yeah, and dies at 17 years of age or something like that. But he moves from different worldviews, if you will. Mm. And I think it's in the 90s. Is it the 90s when he finally becomes a Christian after hearing
Ambrose
preach.
Mm-hmm. He goes because he wants to hear what a good rhetorician. Like, how do you?
He shows up to listen to him preach because this man is renowned for his rhetoric, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the subject that Augustine loves. And it's interesting, Adam, you brought up that he dabbled in Manichaeism. I think it's important for the listeners to say what that is. I mean, essentially, it's hard determinism, right? That every from a pagan perspective, not Christian determinism, that God's determining mm-hmm. everything, but it's a hard determinism, that you may think you're making choices X, Y, and Z in your life and that those choices are free, but really those choices are predetermined.
Yeah, and in addition to that, it is there in Manichaeism, there's a sort of embedded polemic against Christianity. Mm-hmm. The Manichaeism teaches that the sources of Christianity, the Bible, for example, is unreliable. I think there's a bit of, correct me if I'm wrong, a bit of Gnosticism to it. There's an emphasis on the spiritual, the soul, over against the material and the physical. But it is, isn't it, it sees the world as the events in the world, the events in your own life is sort of basically guided by the forces of good and evil struggling against each other.
It's interesting. I think that comes in, I hope we remember to get to it, but I think the sort of early touch base with Manichaeism probably has a little bit of influence in some of his later doctrines, especially like predestination and where he lands on some of that.
But that's all really tied in too with the Persian idea of this great cosmic story, the Zoroastrian narrative where you've got these two kind of equal forces of good and evil. And it's, as you know, C.S. Lewis said, that kind of dualism is the manliest alternative to Christianity, because at least you can say, you know, the good God, he's all right. But evil is just always going to be with us, and so there's this perpetual struggle between good and evil. God didn't create evil. Evil is a substance. Evil is a something that's kind of always up against the good. And at the end of time, you're going to figure out, are you on the side of more good or more evil? So it's very, to the human reason, if you're going to make up your own religion, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you've got your judgment, you've got your good guys winning, and that is satisfying to him. But then when he goes and sees the actual gurus of the thing, he says, these guys don't have anything. He was a smart guy. Whatever you want to say about Augustine, he was a very intelligent man, and he realized that this
naturally
was the
smart
fool on the hill. You know?
I mean, because he even accused himself of not being aggressive in his academic pursuits, especially in his youth, right? So, but he's just naturally and brilliant, really.
Yeah. He didn't like Greek.
Didn't like Greek.
You know, I mean, there were things that he didn't appreciate, but it's
Like arithmetic.
Yeah.
Excelled in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a student in that he sat at his feet, but he read deeply from Cicero.
Right.
And so the sort of stoicism of Cicero would have resonated.
I think so, yeah.
And played some role in the shaping of his worldview later on.
Well, and also the shaping of his expectations for what Holy Scripture would look like. He wanted Paul and the other biblical writers to be as elegant and as eloquent and use the languages properly as the great classical folks, and that was a trouble for him, too.
And he's a student of rhetoric, which would, in his time period, would set him up really to pursue a professional career in public life or law, right?
That's a way to get ahead in the world if you don't have, you know, innate wealth.
Well, and you see this in later characters. I mean, you see this in Martin Luther, though, too, right?
It's amazing how many of the best theologians started out not as theologians but as lawyers.
Right.
Because I think one of the things that's valuable for...
Or those who pursued rhetoric in some form.
Yes, but then they see things in a different way. So, for instance, Luther, Melanchthon, Calvin, Beza, and Augustine, they all have an understanding of what it means to be in a courtroom. And they understand what it means to be a person who everyone knows you're guilty, but in the eyes of the law, you're not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows somebody to see something that a hard moralist or a Pelagius
will never get.
They can't get. They can't get how you can be actually guilty, but treated by the law as if you're innocent. And that's something that's really important for the Western Church, even if it gets kind of squelched by the Middle Ages.
So early in life, right, so when he's like 16 or 17 years old, he starts to travel for his education. He goes to Carthage. And at Carthage, he enters into sort of a, what we'd call it, shacking up probably, long-term. And he's a pagan at this point, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Enters into a shacking up relationship with, which is long term for him.
But he really loves her.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And guess what? Monica, for all her Christian values, doesn't want them to get married because this is going to be a problem for him if he wants to be advancing in the social world, because she's beneath him. So there's mom picking which marriage, and so in fact, one of the weird things, this is something true for Constantine as well. Sometimes Baptists will point to some of these folks who get baptized later in life and say, see, infant baptism is a problem. It wasn't like that. They thought you had a free get-out-of-jail card when you got baptized. So if you could get baptized right before you died, man, you're going to go straight to the pearly gates. But if you get baptized early, Monica knew that boys will be boys, so he's going to commit sexual sin. She just kind of cynically agreed that that was going to happen. And so, you know, you see this throughout his life. He says things like, you know, Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. He probably goes to church because that's where the nice ladies are. You know, this isn't new. I mean, I would say anybody listening that doesn't hasn't already read the Confessions, you got to go do it, especially if you're a guy. You just got to get in there and say, that's the human struggle to understand, why am I sinful?
Do you have a translation you recommend? We ask that of everybody on the show. Mm.
Well, the Chadwick one's just fine. That's the one I don't know if there's a better one. That's the one that's so earmarked and marked up for me that I couldn't possibly part with
it. I still use the copy that Rod had us go buy at Barnes & Noble because I think he happened to go through Barnes & Noble the day before he taught class and saw that in their little front part there that it was $10 for hard copy. So go get it.
It's going to be harder if you go online and get the public domain stuff that's in archaic language. It might throw you off. Yeah. Anything that's newer is fine.
So it's interesting you bring up the idea of being baptized on the deathbed. Wasn't his father baptized on his deathbed, right?
I can't remember that.
Yeah, I think he was. That's interesting.
Might have been.
All right, so what else? What do we need to know about Augustine, like, sort of pre-
All right, he starts the whole thing out. I mean, well, pre-conversion, he tells the story, I think, in a very good way. He says, you know, Lord, you've made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And so his story is trying to fill this God-shaped vacuum in his heart with philosophy, with sex, with smashing some pears, as the Rolling Stones sang on the album Bridges to Babylon. Augustine knew temptation. He loved women, wine, and song, and all the simple pleasures of doing something wrong. And so what he was looking for, he was looking to scratch this God itch. And he realized that all these things, even the gladiatorial games, everything that he had been kind of going through was an attempt to figure out a relationship with God and with peace, but he didn't understand the language of it. And so once he finally understood how through Christ a reconciliation with God could provide the things that he was trying to get with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, to use modern...
Isn't that interesting? I mean, one of the interesting parts of the story of Melanchthon is how much it coincides to a modern telling of such a thing. Is just that you have this person who's restless. He really is trying to find himself through sex, drugs, and rock and roll of his time. And we look at situations like that in the youth of our day, and we think it's completely unique. That this has never happened before, and the sort of degradation of society and of the youth and everything is brand new. And, you know, along comes the story of Augustine, and you find out one of our greatest heroes of the faith really struggled up until his 20s, right? Through his 20s.
And he trusted in the grace of God so much that he thought that instead of trying to be this perfect bishop that is obviously pure and saintly, he's going to show, in fact, no, this isn't the kind of person that God brings into his fold. It's these kind of lost and wayward boys that God receives in. And precisely because he's somebody who had great sin in his life and regrets, that was very important for people to hear, instead of this idea that, you know, the church isn't the place for pure people, it's a hospital. That's a really important, I think.
Or a morgue.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but not a place for people who already had their stuff together.
Right. Yeah, so some just interesting things that happened to him. I mean, he's 22 years old. He loses his best friend. That hits him pretty hard.
Yep.
I mean, that's a significant move in his life. At this point, he's teaching, right? He's no longer a student. He's teaching. I love the fact that he's kind of... He opens up schools to teach and to teach rhetoric. He sort of makes his own opportunities, which I think is a really interesting part of the story.
The Confessions, as Jeff mentioned, are worth reading because many times the reader will say, my gosh, this guy has been peeking into my own diary because it's so familiar.
And it's an interesting thing, too, because we think that by just kind of pretending that the kind of normal struggles of human existence and sexual sin and so forth is just something we kind of want to brush away. And it's the same thing with the Old Testament. Like, you can have a very significant commitment to biblical teaching on sexual ethics, for instance. That doesn't mean that you're going to have to pretend that stuff that you deal with physiologically and with your libido and so forth isn't there. I mean, that's the key insight. It's not this kind of superhuman thing. It's a very honest thing, kind of going, you know, forward to Luther's idea of sinning boldly. It's not like you want to sin more. It's that you just, it's like in AA. Nobody comes to AA and is embarrassed that they had been drinking. That's why you're there.
That's why you're there. Yeah, I like that. All right, so we're going to hit the break, but I just want to point out, you told this great story at the beginning where Augustine's on the dock and he has to hide from his mom. Does anybody remember how old he was when this happens? I mean, he's not a teenager. He's 29.
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
He's 29.
That makes the story more uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
I mean, this is how sort of
she was always there.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to, on that note of our abhorrent thinking about his mother here, we're going to take our first break.
All right. Welcome to our break. Today we're going to let Dr. Jeff Mallinson talk about the podcast that he produces, and he is he's the main host, along with Dr. Dan Van Voris, who's been on our show as well, Virtue in the Wasteland. It's one of now three 1517 Legacy projects and the original 1517 Legacy Project podcast. So, Jeff, could you talk about Virtue in the Wasteland, why listeners of the Thinking Fellows might want what's a different flavor of podcasting over what you guys do?
Why do they need to go OG? Yeah.
Nobody needs to go. What it is it's been funny. We've had...
it's like, what's OG?
No, I do. What's been funny is like the number of Wisconsin Synod listeners, if that means anything to people, or folks who are interested in the ideas of the Reformation, but aren't really connected to a group, like, you know, they're not in a specific denomination or synod. It's what we're doing in Virtue in the Wasteland is taking the other half of the Reformation. I don't know if Dan mentioned this, but you've got that street. You got Luther, Melanchthon, and then down the road is Cranach. And the way in which the Reformation allows people to start to see their service to God through vocation and what we call the left-hand kingdom. So that's kind of what we talk about there. And it is an exploration of cultural issues and sometimes, you know, more historical stuff like we're doing here, but not overtly theological. The main thing is it's our attempt to kind of just, you know, kind of mellow out and figure out, well, now that we are, you know, people who really care about the Reformation's theology, what is that going to look like in day-to-day life? And what is it going to look like in terms of all sorts of things from education to politics? And the thing, though, that listeners should know is that it's not like this show where you are actually on track. We just kind of meander. It's the kind of show you want to listen to when you're falling asleep or driving in the car or working out. And
I think driving in the car or working out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure you can fall asleep.
I'll tell you the main thing. Virtueinthewasteland.com is where you can go to check out the show notes. If you're interested, you have to just go through the menu and see what shows you like. We've got Uwe Simonetto talking about...
Yeah, you guys have it vocation. Curated over on your website. So if you're used to Thinking Fellows, we have kind of an archive and things like that. But you guys have done so many different topics. You guys have kind of like big topical sections.
I think if for folks who like this kind of conversation, go check out our stuff on 1517. We're actually talking about the year 1517. The lead up, the late medieval world. It's a series we did a few months ago. And then what was so important about the 95 Theses, and then what happens after that. So we'll do stuff like that, and then we'll have crazy things like we'll interview a country musician and so forth. But it's really, for us, it's been really cool because it's more about that camaraderie that we had when we were, well, at least a few of us, right, together hanging out after Dr. Rosenblatt's class. We might hang out and have a cigar and just talk about life. So what we tried to do is capture that experience, sitting around having cigars and talking about all sorts of things as if we were students again. So a lot of our listeners are people that kind of long for those days when you could just sit around and talk. That's what we do.
Do you still rap? You know, I did an episode.
Jeff Kinrath, almost on the drop of a dime.
Yeah, I did an episode with him on the Crusades, I think it was.
And Dan's still upset by this.
It's the only one I listen to because I just don't have time.
Dan is mad at me, but there have been requests for the Urban 2 rap. It's about the launching of the Crusades. And in fact, my son, Aiden, was singing it as he was walking through the house. He said, "Hey, girl, this is Urban. This is Urban 2." And, and Dan was there, and he was upset. He's like, "Why did you ruin the podcast?" It's because he didn't know how to edit at the time.
No, I listen, because I don't like listening to myself.
Oh, I hate it, too.
I'm going to listen to it just to make
very anxiety-inducing.
Right. And I'm listening to it, and all of a sudden, he busts into a rap about Urban II and the Crusades. It was actually really good.
You should hear the potty training song. Man.
People have asked for it. They'll pay 99 cents a track, but you should record
the potty training song. It's
a good
great.
One.
It's good.
Soon to be available at shop.1517legacy.com. Fantastic. Anyway, so I will put the link to Virgin Wasteland in the show notes.
Listeners are going to be like, what the heck happened?
Yeah.
That's right.
I have infected you with the ethos of Virtue in the Wasteland. That's what it's like. If you hated everything
like,
the last few minutes.
We just put our slippers on and sat under the fire.
They told me I could relax.
Well, let's get back to business then so I don't pollute this thing.
That's great.
All right. So we talked about the early life of Augustine. So for the second half of the show... again, transition to later work?
Yeah, what I'd like to do is, so we did sort of the pagan Augustine in the first half. Let's talk about the Christian Augustine.
Can I mention something about the transition? And then I'll just kind of take a back seat if I can. The thing that's interesting is when people ask me, why did you name your oldest son Augustine? Aren't there some significant problems with him? And there are. One of the ones that is, I find, most disturbing is he contributes in many ways to the Western churches, especially the Catholic Church's idea that sex is kind of a necessary evil. It's gonna get you a little bit tangled up in the thing that you really should be doing. And I love Augustine, but I don't get as much of a kick out of his Neoplatonism. And in Neoplatonism, you're trying to ascend up this great chain of being. And if you imagine that the material world is kind of like a ball and chain, kind of holding you down, but you're like a spiritual helium balloon, and you're going to float up to the heavens, well, what's getting in the way? Family. Women.
Because I was going to say, I've heard other people describe his Paul's chains.
I know, that's what I'm saying. And in many ways, we could do a whole show on the ways in which Augustine, his relationship to his mom kind of screws up the entire Western church for like 1,500 years. A thousand years at least. And because he is in fact hindered. So his concubine is kind of a distraction. His mom is a distraction. But more importantly, before he even becomes a Christian, he recounts this in the Confessions. He says, why don't we all get together, he's talking to his buddies, and just get a commune together where we can just talk about Plato and philosophy and rhetoric. And the only thing is, just don't get married, because the women are going to get in the way, right? He couldn't imagine that you could. And it's an allure for all of us who've studied. It's great. If you don't have any family distractions, you can finish your dissertation. You can write that article. You can do whatever you need to do.
But I'd miss the sex.
It wasn't primarily,
Does that work for the clean rating? Do I wonder?
Mm-hmm. No. He was not really originally basing it on biblical or even Pauline rationality. He was already on this jag of a kind of celibacy that was more Neoplatonic, I think, and didn't value the sort of embodiment that you see later in Luther, who loves, stones and wood and beer. He's trying to kind of ascend up to the heavens. So that's probably, I think, the thing that we would, be a little bit more hesitant about.
It probably should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but then he becomes a Christian.
Then he becomes a Christian, right? I think it's funny is that he tries to. The title of the show should be Augustine's Mom. he tries to ditch her at 29. She shows up though, right? He's headed to Milan. He heads to Milan. He's there for a year and a half or so.
When she dies, he's holding her in his arms. And does he go to the promises in John? No, he goes back to texts on the way of ascent.
Yeah.
Oh.
Not wild.
Wow. Yeah, so she shows up, right? She shows up in Milan and a couple years later and tries to marry him off or does marry him off. But it's when he's 32, he has a spiritual conversion. So what happens? What's the deal there?
I think you already talked about it a little bit, right? It's the problem of evil that was getting in the way.
Yeah, and he hears Ambrose mm-hmm. preach, and
and hears a child's voice from over the hedge saying in Latin, "Take and read, take and read," and he does Bible baseball. He opens the Bible up, blindly puts his finger on a verse, and then reads to see what it says.
Tola lege, tola lege.
Yeah. And it falls on a verse in later part of Romans. And I hear this, and I go, holy smokes, the greatest father of the Christian church. And that's how he comes in, from a child's voice saying, take and read, and then doing Bible baseball.
Bibliomancy.
Goodness gracious.
Ends up in Romans 13, right?
Yep.
13 and 14. Let us behave decently as in the daytime, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissension and jealousy. Rather, clothe yourselves with the Lord Jesus Christ and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh.
Heavenly days.
Pretty law. Pretty law.
Yeah.
Heavy.
Yeah.
But it's what he needed to hear. That was him. He's like, well, that's me. I'm the carouser. He could have stumbled upon some kind of random proverb. It wouldn't have done as much. But that was who he was.
Yeah. And so he's baptized following a year, I think, by Ambrose, right? By this bishop that he went to hear. And he takes up and reads, and he lands on that verse, and he's baptized.
Total trivia for your seminary listeners. He sees Ambrose, and he's reading. And he's not moving his mouth, or he's moving his mouth, but he's not saying anything. And he was just shocked by this. It's like, well, you can't read without saying it out loud. It was the first time that this made sense to anybody. Like you could
read in your head,
think the words. Kind of Platonic in that way too, because it wasn't something to be necessarily spoken, but something internal. But Ambrose, rocked his world.
So let's shift gears a little bit. So he's a Christian now, right? And he very sort of, I think, pretty quickly becomes a contributor, really, to sort of the heritage of the faith from that point on. Founds a monastery, even starts writing. What is he known for theologically? Like, what are the important works and theologically, which doctrines was he a heavy hitter on? And, you know, if our listeners want to read and sort of take up some Tola Lege, some Augustine, what should they take up? And
certainly the Confessions first.
Yeah.
And if you want to pursue, just know beforehand that it's a pretty hefty thing, and that's the City of God. We'll talk a little bit about that, I'm sure. But it's no small Reader's Digest handbook.
No, it's a
22 books.
Yes.
Yeah, it's difficult. Like 900 pages. Difficult work.
Yes. Yeah. But it was the first work in apologetics. He saw it as necessary because Christians were blamed for the fall of Rome. Mm-hmm. Had we not adopted Christianity, we wouldn't be in this mess.
Right.
And he took up pen to answer that charge.
I mean, from the perspective of history, Adam, what's going on? You've got a real claim. Was it Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Western or of the Roman Empire, where he's basically saying, yeah, it was Christianity that did kind of weaken it because they didn't value power and and all this.
But yeah, well, in the 410 AD, there, for over a century, Germanic people from the northern parts of Europe had been migrating and been allowed to settle in the Roman Empire.
Even they were allowed to become soldiers. At some
yeah,
point, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Which influenced the society dramatically.
Absolutely, but then in the late fourth, early fifth century, these barbarian tribes, if you will, as they're called barbarians, recognize that at least Western Rome is relatively politically weak. And they take the opportunity to begin kind of carving out their own kingdoms within the western half of the empire. And in 410 AD, a guy named Alaric the Goth rolls right into Rome with his barbarian tribe and sacks the city, rapes women, except for the Christian churches there. They're largely left untouched. But all the pagan temples and the Vestal Virgins and things are molested. And in the aftermath of that, people start asking the question, what on earth happened? Rome is the navel of the world. It's the empire that would never fail. And the answer on the part of the old sort of pagan aristocracy that are still around, even though we're about a century after Constantine, They argue the reason why Rome has become weak is because people are increasingly embracing Christianity.
Yeah.
And people are turning their backs on the gods, and so the gods are turning their backs on Rome. And Augustine hears this charge, and actually his friends encourage him to write a response to that claim. He starts around 413 AD. 22 books later, in the 420s, around 425, 426, he finishes the book. And it's a masterpiece in Christian apologetics. The first 10 books are kind of a negative apologetic, an attack on sort of these pagan claims. And he goes through every available text he can get his hands on of pagan theology and shows how it's irrational, it doesn't correspond to the real world, it's incoherent, and so on. Then in book 11 to book 22, it's more of a positive apologetic. It's a construction, if you will, of the, if you'll let me use the word, of the Christian worldview. And it is a masterpiece. And it gets in every conceivable topic, from the problem of evil to the Christianity and its relationship to the state. All the major doctrines of Christianity are treated, and ultimately comes up in the end. His position on Christians and their place in the world is that Christians are in the world, but they're on pilgrimage. And so politics, horizontal things, do matter. Justice matters and things like that. But ultimately, what really matters is your final destiny, and that's outside of time and space and what he calls eternal blessedness. So his advice to Christians, and you're sort of looking top down on the text, is don't be so concerned about things going on here, there, and everywhere. Don't be so concerned about barbarian invasions and things like that. Be more concerned about resting in Christ. So the book is, as you said, Dr. Rosemont, huge, and it's very, very difficult. I actually taught a course on it once, and I had the students buy a reader's guide to the City Smart. Of God, because there's so many references to classical literature.
Right. That's all. You find that in a lot of these guys. Like, I think there's not a lot of Melanchthon that's translated, but if there were more translation of Melanchthon, you'd need a reader's guide to all of his classical references.
Yeah.
I mean, because he take these, and that's several hundred years, many hundred years later, but these people were so well educated in the classics that they take these references for granted, mm-hmm. and we just can't.
Yeah.
We just can't.
Now, and that's a precursor to, you know, what we're interested in with Virtue in the Wasteland, precursor to the Two Kingdoms. Now, it's a little different, but in what you described, that helps, because you have other types of Christianity that want to maybe dominate the world. In many ways, this allows us to have a very pragmatic view of the best politics. So what does it mean for today? You know, and to skip, just to apply, you know, look at Barack Obama, just for a second. I don't think he was a Muslim, right? Like, we were talking about this. I think he was very consistently a liberationist kind of Christian.
Liberation theologian, right. If he had any theology at all.
He had a progressive kind of, let's assume he's true to his word. He was a guy who had a progressive kind of Christianity and thinks the state is going to enact this. And you have some people on the religious right, for instance, that would want the state to enact a very explicitly Christian values, maybe in the Reformed tradition, what's known as theonomy. Augustine says, you know, there really are these two kind of realms going on. This becomes very important for Luther, and I think Luther is better at being able to articulate what that means in the so-called two kingdoms. But Luther gets it from Augustine and kind of runs from there, and it's important because your alternative is all sorts of millenarian kind of cults that want to impose, like Thomas Munzer, you know, Christianity through the sword.
Yeah, you get extreme Anabaptist movement.
Yeah.
They're creating little theocracies everywhere with little emperors everywhere that are doing the will of God.
So he's incredibly important for the West being able to wrestle with, how do you do great statecraft and not try to bring, you know, Jesus' concern for the poor doesn't necessarily mean that you have to serve the poor directly through the state. You know, I mean, there's implications.
Well, and we would even say, I think, theologically, that Jesus' concern for the poor often has to do with defining down the law so that you have no excuse, as much as it has to do with Concern for the Poor.
It's not a program for some kind of weird political theocracy.
Yeah, it's like Matthew 18 isn't necessarily a program for how to handle conflict.
Right.
While it can be that, and it maybe is that, it's really Jesus getting to the pointy end of the stick of the law and saying, listen, you have no other option here but me. That whole series, and I think that's where some of this goes wrong too with liberation theology. But beyond that, before we end, I do want to hit maybe Rod and Jeff. Give us sort of the major contributions to theology from Augustine. I mean, you obviously have the idea of a sovereign God who saves by grace alone.
Yeah, grace understood not necessarily in our sense, but yes, God gets the credit. In a way that was precursor to what Luther wrote.
And Luther was an Augustinian monk originally, right? So there's a heavy influence of Augustine.
Yep.
Augustine influences later doctrines of predestination pretty heavily.
Yeah, I think we at least should give 30 seconds to the major conflict with Donatism and with Pelagius.
Right.
Those are the defining fights, and many times you find out a lot about a guy when he says, this one's worth a fight.
Yeah.
Well, so, let's do it.
Pelagius basically said the doctrine of original sin isn't, and every baby's born as innocent as Adam, and we go bad because we see bad stuff on the playground and we copy it.
Sure, nurture, not nature.
Yep. It's a clean position. It isn't as if it equivocates. It's just awful. It's completely anti-Pauline, but... that was one of them. And the Donatist controversy came up when, after persecution and some people had flaked out, the answer of the Donatists was, you don't get to come back, we don't care why.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no, forever.
Mm-hmm.
And Augustine entered into that one and said, you're wrong on that. The repentance after even that... is to be accepted straightforwardly, and they're to be welcomed back because of Christ.
Christ covers even that.
And that was not a popular position within Christian circles, but he knew it had to be fought.
Yeah, apostatism was, you know, verboten, right?
So Or another ramification of it was, if your own priest is not in a state of grace, then anything sacramental is void for you.
Right.
In other words, so you have every encouragement to follow your pastor around to see if he's in grace.
Right, you have the indelible character of the priesthood, where if the priesthood's character is not up to standard, then his actions on your behalf are not either.
Exactly. And Augustine said, that one's worth the fight.
Yeah.
He says that the church is a mixed body, and this goes directly against all of those sectarian groups that want to make sure that everybody is just absolutely pure. Both, I mean, in all sorts of ways. But what I think that contributes is, if he did 1,000 more stupid things, you know, if he corrupted the church by accident and 1,000 other ways, what that was, it was something, that idea that the sacraments, the preaching of the word, is going to have its own power despite the corruption of the priest.
That's right.
That is incredibly important later on in the Reformation, because they're all worried that maybe it's not working. You know, Luther's emphasis on looking to your baptism and saying that is this thing that, no matter how I'm feeling today, or no matter how boring or silly my church is, that thing is the guarantee of God's unconditional love for me. And Augustine being able to say that really, I think, saved as many potential problems in the history of the church as he could have ever, you know, caused a problem on. And that is important, because it's about the word itself. When the sacraments are accompanied by the word, that is why you know it's good. It's not because of your heart. It's not how much you just kind of twerked yourself around so that you felt great about Holy Communion or baptism. Uh-uh. It was the word and the sacraments and the power that those things have because of who God is, not the church itself.
And what he declares those things to be.
Yeah.
And you, by virtue of their benefit in connection to the word. I say amen to that, and I don't want to get myself in trouble, but I think that some of the modern conversation would benefit from a better understanding of what you just said.
Yep.
So, you know, we could probably do another several hours on Augustine, but the nature of our show is that this is the time we have, and it was great to have you, Dr. Mallinson.
Yeah,
thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll have Dr. Mallinson back. He's going to talk about Calvin and talk about Beza. I can't wait to talk to you about Beza, to be honest with you, because
That's the only thing I'm actually an expert on.
Well, I don't know about that, but I know you're an expert on it. So we'll do that, and thank you for listening.
All right, we'll catch you next time.